In just a moment, conversation. But first,
here's the way NBC Radio cooks up a dish you're sure to enjoy. First, we take Eddie Howard and his orchestra, add songs by Dick Hames, and then blend with the music of Tex Beneke. We spice with comedy, sprinkle with games and contests, and stir with jack-of-all-trades master of ceremonies, Burt Parks. And lo and behold, we have an NBC Bandstand, a refreshing dish of entertainment that really gives you a lift in the morning. And the NBC Bandstand won't add an inch to your waistline.
Now stay tuned for Conversation on NBC.
Before talking about how one should live in the mid-20th century, I thought we might go back for a few minutes or so and try to reconstruct very briefly varying conceptions of the good life that people have had in the past.
This is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Clifton Fadiman, editor of the American Treasury, is our host. His guests tonight are Nancy Kelly and Jacques Barzin. This transcribed program started several minutes ago, and as we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are discussing some historical components of the good life and our good life, mid-century style. Clifton Fadiman is speaking.
Mr. Barzin, if you go back to, let's say, Greek times, where we often begin, what conceptions of the good life are laid down by the classical authors?
Well, there are several, depending on the period of antiquity that you dip into. The classic view of Aristotle, of course, is that the good man exercises virtue in almost complete freedom. He doesn't work, he has amiable and well-to-do friends, and all his acts are an expression of conscious choice, and of course, the choice results in activity. It's an energy of the soul tending towards virtue, or words to that effect.
Good enough. Would you say, then, that that conception of the good life is dependent upon a slave system?
It certainly is, and it's one that is so completely divorced from work that I think we couldn't possibly import it into the modern world.
What do you think, Miss Kelly?
Well, it's such an interesting interesting parallel in relation to American life. It seems to me in America today there is such a sense of guilt that is always associated with leisure of any kind.
Just the opposite in Greek times.
Yes, really the opposite.
We don't mind leisure as long as it's filled with activity. That is to say, a man is perfectly willing to play 8 or 10 hours of golf a day, I understand, and feels that he's fulfilling his functions.
Yes, I should like to know more, though, about the influence of climate and diet and other things. But I suppose that in all these views, too, there is something that you might call projective. That is, no one has ever lived the good life. Maybe the good life is a contradiction in terms, really.
Do you think it's something that's imposed on us from above by moral philosophers as something which doesn't actually seep down to Joe Doakes in general?
And yet, I think that if everyone in the world were a practicing, really, truly practicing Jew or Episcopalian or Catholic or Methodist or whatever denomination you might want to use, I believe that this would be utopia. There would be no problems in the world.
Well, Miss Kelly, I have a few objections to that. In the first place, the difficulty of interpreting the moral rules that any religion gives, they do require interpretation because life presents all sorts of practical problems that have to be settled. Do they belong under this rule or that one? I think that there may well be, what Mr. Fadiman suggested, such a difference in temperaments among human beings that no one system could possibly suit. For example, the rule that we should return violence with kindness, turn the other cheek. That's possible for some people of saintly temperament. It's utterly impossible for others. And perhaps for the great majority, it's a repression of aggression which turns dangerous. These decalogues are counsels of perfection towards which we can strive, but they're not rules that we can use.
Some are, but I do think that they're intended, on the whole, for angels. And what they say is, let us strive to be as much like angels as we can be. We do understand that the term the good life has two kinds of definitions. The first kind of definition is that laid down by authority in religious doctrine, in dogma, in the form of ideals. But if you ask an average person, such as ourselves, what kind of life he would like to live, which is what we mean by the good life, he's not apt to answer in doctrinal or religious terms at all. He might say something extremely simple-minded like, I'd like not to be able to work and have 24 hours a day in which to do nothing and play golf as much as possible or go to baseball games as much as possible.
The good life is not the life of goodness, in other words.
No. It was at one time. That is to say, I think in the Middle Ages, if you had asked the average person what the good life was, he would have given forth with doctrines. What would you think most people would say if you just ask them the question point blank, what's the good life for you?
I was telling Mr. Barzan when I came in today about seeing an advertisement in one of the magazines that was put out by one of our larger concerns, which has to do with not public utilities necessarily, but refrigerators, freezers, this kind of appliance. And this was a two-page advertisement in a magazine, and it was all based on the thought that we have brains working day in and day out in our organization to make the good life for you. And it seemed that the good life was based really on who had the biggest freezer or the biggest stove or the best running
Let's give it a nicer name, Miss Kelly. It's called gracious living, I believe.
I suppose it is. This is not a phrase that was used in this advertisement, however.
What beyond that do you think represents our notion? We know what the Greeks felt, at least the Greeks, Greek aristocrats. Contemplation they placed very high, at least Plato places it high. They placed a certain kind of gymnastic high, didn't they, Mr. Barzan?
The cultivation
of the body.
Yes.
We do too
in a different way.
What's the difference, though? There is a real difference.
Well, they attained it, I suppose, through exercise and outdoor life, and they loved beautiful men and women, worshipped them, in fact. We do too, but we do it through the stage, through the motion pictures, through picture magazines, by proxy. But everybody is now concerned about health in a manner that would have made the Greeks stare.
But they're absorbed in the notion of health out of a kind of sense of guilt or fear.
Yes.
People talk about keeping fit as if you didn't keep fit, heaven only knows what would happen to you, what disaster would come around
the
corner.
Yes.
Or you keep fit in order to work harder and more efficiently. You don't keep fit as the Greeks thought you should keep fit because it's pleasant to have a good body that can be handled with pleasure and agility.
The self-regarding attitudes are out of favor, aren't they? At least in words, you are supposed to do nothing for yourself and everything for your neighbor, the community, your country, and...
In a sense, we're better people than the Greeks, less self-regarding.
Well, it is more altruistic, ostensibly.
Yes.
Well, I don't know whether it's altruistic or communal. The two things are not quite the same. That is, I wonder whether we don't do things for other people in order to keep the community efficiently organized and going efficiently, rather than because we love our neighbor. The two things, I think, are somewhat different.
Perhaps we think that we are paying back what we get in the way of comfort, or maybe comfort is the reward for this outward activity. Comfort is quite a modern and strange notion. The things Miss Kelly was referring to, dishwashing machines and the like, would have seemed to most populations... superfluities.
Yeah.
Not that they were less materialistic. They wanted large houses and gilt cornices and plushy sofas and all those things.
Well, no, not if you go back far enough. In the Middle Ages, for example, they're attached to the idea of poverty. There was praise and goodness attached to the idea of poverty.
Yes.
Nowadays, don't we tend to think of poverty certainly as an evil? And in some cases, some people think of it as a sin.
But you didn't find the great majority seeking poverty in the Middle Ages.
They got it whether they sought it or not, in most cases.
They used the poor very much as we used Hollywood stars as...
objects of adoration.
Yes, they were doing it for them.
Well, certainly, poverty, asceticism, self-denial, that whole collection of ancient virtues has dropped out of our vocabulary, Miss Kelly. I mean, you don't find people preaching it very much.
Not generally,
these days.
No. Not generally.
Also, it may have to do with our economic setup. Self-denial doesn't make things go. Buying and selling doesn't exist on the notion of self-denial.
No. So it goes with war and plunder.
Yes, and the notion of goods being something to be consumed rather than to be accumulated. What other notions do we have with respect to the good life, do you think? I hope I'm not being too inquisitive, Miss Kelly, if I ask you whether you yourself ever think of what the ideal life for you would be.
Yes, at the risk of sounding smug, I would like to submit at this point that I found it. I find for the first time in my life that I am doing what I am made to do and what I am here to do, to create a child or to help create one.
Yes.
And I find that this is a tremendously rewarding experience in my life. I am content. I am happy. This is a very simple thing. I am a woman and I'm about to have a child. And this to me is the most settling experience in my whole life.
It really is.
Aside from what material successes might have obtained in my life up to this point.
No one could quarrel with that, of course, but you are not differentiating yourself from any other woman that has ever lived or will live when you say that.
No, of course I'm not. I'm only telling you from my experience what is happening to me. I may be speaking for every other woman in the world who's gone through this experience. However, if we take that one step further and get to some kind of concept of a good life for ourselves, I find that it is important then to do what we are meant to do, if we happen to be talented in one direction or another, not to frustrate that need or that desire or that talent. And if we are lucky enough, as for instance Mr. Barzan I'm sure is, he seems to be doing, just from my observation, what he wants to do in the world and what he enjoys doing.
I agree with the principle. That is, we should, as far as possible, all of us do what we feel we're meant to do. But there are so many interruptions to that. You will not always be concerned with your child. And you could not, of course, turn like some women of a few generations ago into a mere factory for producing children. That is dreadful, both to behold and for the woman herself. So that there have to be other things than this thing we might call right activity. Shaw put it very well when he said that he wanted to... Get as much work out of himself before being thrown on the scrap heap as he could.
Do you think that sums it up, though, Mr. Barzan?
But I think there have to be other things. I would want to add, for example, to Miss Kelly's first specification, a proper balance between choice and duty. We have to have both. But I think that... For most of us nowadays, the balance is upset. I don't mean that it might not average out over a whole life, but at any one time, it's wrong.
You mean too much duty, too little choice, I guess.
Or, yes, mostly, but sometimes it's the other way around, too. And then I should like to reserve a kind of small but perfectly free space for eccentricity, which I think we've lost altogether out of this life. And which is very necessary.
Of course, it's not a thing you can cultivate as you would an orchid.
No, but you ought not to check your... You
ought not feel guilty about it.
That's right. And your neighbors ought not to pounce on you.
On the contrary, they ought to encourage you.
As a spectacle.
I think they should.
Yes.
No.
Well, yes. I think eccentricity ought to be encouraged, just like baseball. This balance between choice and duty interests me very much. You talk, Mr. Barzan, as if it were possible to determine... A, what the proper choices are, and B, just what your duties are. I think the great difficulty with most of us in trying to find out what kind of good lives we should lead is that we don't know ourselves well enough to make proper choices. It would be rather easy if we knew who we were to say, well, now I'm a writer, I'm going to write for the rest of my life, or I'm an actress and I'm going to act for the rest of my life. But most of us spend 60 or 70 years blundering around in a forest of self-exploration and never come into a clearing.
Well, that's why I made it point two. I took Miss Kelly's point as point one, that is, we know what we are good for. All right. Having discovered that, as she luckily has, we go on to, as it were, set this talent into a set of conditions or circumstances that will both keep it fresh and alive and preserve the thing that holds the talent. The analogy with creating a child is just the same.
Well, you make it all sound pretty easy.
And then whatever realistic setbacks there are along the way, I think tend to make it more exciting. I really do. I find with every minor goal that I have reached, that I've set for myself and have reached, along with the reaching of that goal comes a kind of restlessness and on to the next thing, you know, and the next goal. And to reach the final goal for oneself, I should think, would be really horrible.
In other words, you welcome a certain amount of setback and friction.
Yes, and because dislocation. I think this makes it necessary to use yourself, really use yourself to the best of your ability.
It's an interesting point, because if you ask most people what their conception of the good life included, I think it would involve ease. That is, no friction, no setbacks, no poverty, no disillusionment.
But this is why you, if you look around you, you'll find that most men, for instance, in their 50s or late 50s or early 60s, who retire, strangely enough, become very dissatisfied, restless, empty, and I think die sooner, actually, than men who keep active and keep busy with a job to do in the world.
It's probably because what they've been doing, which has created habits just like smoking, isn't something that really was inside them. It was something imposed from outside, so they can't continue doing it once they've retired.
Well, I think it's something even deeper than that, and I think it goes back to your good friend Aristotle, Mr. Barzan. I think that the difficulty is this, that at 50 or 60, when they retire, they are for the first time faced with the opportunity for reflection and with no ability for it.
Yes.
And this is a dreadful thing.
It is.
This is
nothing
to smile at, because it's a tragic situation.
Consider that man who's retired when he was a young man. He had plenty of ability to look into himself and to make a choice, but people told him, no, you don't want to do that, meaning it's what you want to do, but I won't let you. And so he's worked himself into being a sort of universal joint for other people's machinery to grind, and that leaves him a worn part instead of a human being.
Aren't we saying, in essence, that we are leaving out one of the great Greek ingredients, to wit, the contemplative life, the notion that part, and indeed a major part, of man's successful and harmonious activity involves mere thinking. That is, thinking not for any particular practical purpose, not in order to pay the rent. That notion is heretical in our country, and I don't advance it, of course, because it would be heresy to advance it.
Well, it's only advanced, isn't it, as another extreme, which would be very bad. If you do nothing but contemplate,
sure.
you
yes,
have
except
to have...
Yes, that Mr. Fadiman submits it as a part of
I do
life
submit
and
it.
Not the whole.
I submit it as a part.
Well, then why can't
we
do it?
There's
plenty of time to contemplate.
Yes, why don't we? I think, on the whole, it's because our moral universe doesn't include contemplation as a virtue. In Greek times, it did. In other words, a great man laid it down that you were a better man if you did spend some time in contemplation, and I imagine even the average man of the time felt the authority of that statement. At least we think he did. Now I don't think that would be the case at all. For example, suppose any president that we might have announced in the morning paper, I'm going to spend 4 hours a day thinking. And said he felt this was his duty to the citizens of his country. He would, of course, not only be not reelected, but he would probably be impeached for lunacy. And I'm not at all sure I wouldn't help to impeach him, because the notion of a man announcing that he's going to spend 4 hours a day in philosophical contemplation does sound a little wacky, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yet it wouldn't have sounded wacky some hundreds of years ago.
And yet we recognize a couple of hours a day fishing or golfing.
Sure.
As acceptable.
Yeah, because it's non-contemplated.
Well, perhaps they contemplate while fishing. I've never understood what else there is to do.
I've never understood fishing, actually.
Well, I think the fish are far more alert than the men. I would suggest, however, in our own time, that particular virtue, the virtue of mere reflection, contemplation, is at least a minor one rather than a major one. It doesn't bulk large in our view of the good life. What other things are there that bulk larger, do you think, or that have dropped out?
I think a kind of social reasonableness which has no name of its own, and I don't know whether I'm conveying what I mean, but I think the amount of attention, forethought, effort, emotional output that goes into being a good citizen and being thought a good citizen and making other people good citizens when they happen not to be by nature or inclination is enormous.
Yes, so it is.
We value a kind of non-individual entity, which is growing ever more powerful and sometimes quite lovely, but not always.
And isn't this a kind of modern version of the old Greek feeling that you had to be a citizen or you didn't even exist.
Yes, it may also be a medieval feeling about duty.
Conceivably. Miss Kelly, by the way, started a hair which I should like to pursue. If you don't mind, Mr. Barton, you were saying that you felt that your own conception of the good life involved a proper disposition of the balance between duty and choice. Do you feel, as apparently Miss Kelly does about you, that you're leading an ideal life yourself as educator, writer, administrator?
Well, it's certainly the life I want to lead. I think the conditions of it are not always as happy as they might be. This is partly the city of New York, partly the concentration of activities in the modern university and publishing world. There's just too much to do, not enough time to do it in, and a multitude of perfectly good claims which one feels out of this social reason I was mentioning one has to discharge, which are really not either self-fulfilling or fulfilling the task one has set oneself.
Suppose I put my perhaps impertinent question in a different way. Mr. Barton, you and I were students together at Columbia many years ago. At that time, we studied very hard all these various conceptions of the good life, and I'm sure that we were very idealistic about them and perhaps in our hearts swore that we would adhere to one or the other of them. Has there been, in your own day-to-day life, a considerable, shall we say, declension from those ideals?
Yes, I don't know whether I'm right, but I look back on those days as approaching the kind of balance between duty, contemplation, and effort that was about right. There were moments of crisis, providing the drama Miss Kelly wants to inject into life again. That was fine. But it's been a steady crescendo since. And one feels that there's a point where one explodes like a burst balloon and everybody sends flowers and say, he was doing fine when he collapsed.
Do you feel, Miss Kelly, that, of course, at the moment, I know you feel that you're leading a better life than any that you've led in the past, and I think...
Yes, well, when you mentioned...
Even as a mere male, I understand that.
When you mentioned your and Mr. Barzan's ideals... when you were younger, I am reminded of my idea of the good life when I was 19 years old.
Quite
and this encompassed, of course, the knight in shining armor and living in a house on a hill. And also, I think I was a little preoccupied with the fact that a gentleman should open doors for a lady and light a cigarette. These were all quite important in my life at that time. But as I grew up a little more and I found my life opening up for me and found it becoming much more idealistic on a certain level, at the same time more realistic. It began to grow and to open and to flower, and I find myself being able now to deal a little more sympathetically and a little more understandingly with the people around me and with the projects at hand. I think this goes back to your point earlier, which is that so many people wait until their 60s to find out really what they're about and what they think about and what they want.
Well, you found that you're...
You've been listening to Conversation, a transcribed series of programs dedicated to the art of good talk. Our host was Clifton Fadiman, author of Party of One. His guests tonight were Jacques Barzan, Dean of the Graduate Faculties of Columbia University, and popular stage, screen, and television star Nancy Kelly, who can currently be seen in The Bad Seed.